Blog Talk Radio.
January 8th, 2014. I miss that music. I haven't seen you for a few weeks or heard from you either. Anyway, although over the holidays, a couple of weeks ago, I went to the funeral of my friend's father. I'm just trying to say I had some excitement during the holiday period, and it was an interesting funeral. First, the clergyman spoke. He gave the main eulogy because he was a personal friend of the deceased. So for a half an hour, he told us all about his various talents and accomplishments, and I knew a bit about the guy. It was my friend's father, and actually I knew him before. Just separately, I encountered him myself, so I knew that everything this clergyman said was true. He was a talented guy, multi-talented. But then his kids got up to speak, and, you know, they were very respectful. They maintained the tone that the clergyman set, but the first thing the oldest daughter said was, "My dad wasn't an easy man to have as a father." He actually said, "I don't care if my kids like me, I just want them to do the right thing." And you know what? He got his wish. His kids are all very smart, but none of them seem to like him. Then the grandchildren got up, and you know what? They said the same thing as their parents. I guess they heard the same stories all their lives about how their grandfather was very talented, but very rigid. And here's the proof. The clergyman told us how the fella died. His kids came over to celebrate his 90th birthday. He still lived in his own house, he insisted. And on that night, the power went out. We had a big power blackout here in Toronto. They wanted him to come home with them, but he absolutely refused. And trust me, I know from experience, these old guys are stubborn. You can't tell them what to do. Anyway, it was a cold night. He got sick, and he died a week later from pneumonia. And here's what a friend of mine told me. Not the person who's this father, who had this father. It's another guy. He knew this man as well because he belonged to the same organization, one of the groups he belonged to, a professional group. They were having a special event, and they were going to bring in more people than usual, and it was more than was allowed by the fire regulations, but nobody seemed to care except this one guy, the deceased. And when the other members wouldn't listen to him, he called the fire marshal and snitched on them. Yeah, so it would be hard to say that this fellow was a good dad. But, you know, maybe you could say he had what it took. He had what it takes to be a good leader. He wasn't warm and fuzzy, but he was talented. He demanded high standards. And he had the courage to speak out when people didn't live up to them, just like we do on Jared. Jared! Jared! What show is this?
This is the Recruiting Animal Show! Thank you, thank you. Welcome to 2014.
Do you have any good wishes you want to tell the people for 2014?
No, I wish all my competitors bad luck.
Yeah, okay. Mike, it's going to be a great year. I saw on Facebook. Thank you, Mike. I'm glad you're so sure of that. I hate too much positivity, I got to say. Anyway,
every year is a struggle. Every year is a struggle.
Every year's a struggle. Okay, let's bring the guest out. David Feecat.
Hello.
Are you here?
Feecat?
I'm here.
How do you say your name?
Very carefully. Feecat.
Feecat. You know, I got to tell you, it's F-E-C-A-K. And I know in Central Europe, the C makes a TS sound. So it's Fetsack or Fetsack, something like that. That's not so bad. But Fecak is not good. You should change that name.
Mm. I've been looking into that. But I'm going to keep it for now, at least till the end of the show.
You know, I had an English candidate once, and his name was Freak, his last name, F-R-E-E-K, right? And he changed it. And that's what you should do, too. But, yeah, think about it. Think about it. Even
Jerry
agrees
with
me.
I appreciate the advice. Thank you, sir.
I got to tell you, Jerry doesn't agree with much that I say. Anyway, your website is fecak.com. You're not going to change your name. And your Fecak on Twitter, CAC, F-E-C-A-K, Fecak. Okay.
That's correct.
So here we go. Everybody's got it now. Look, how many people did you recruit on Twitter in 2014, Mr. Fecak?
2014 just started, but if you're referring to 2013.
I'm sorry. Thanks. You're on the call.
This guy is observant. You're not going to pull anything over on this dude.
I like
the way this is going already.
Right, that's for sure.
On Twitter, I would say zero.
You didn't recruit anybody.
Are you still in business?
I don't think I did. I don't think I pulled anyone from Twitter in 2013. I'm not sure I've ever recruited someone from Twitter.
What about Facebook?
I don't use Facebook at all.
Dude, perhaps he's never even heard how easy it is. Look, on Twitter, and I'm gonna lay this on you. This is free. You don't owe me anything.
Thank you.
What you do is you just start off your tweet by saying, "Are you a good fit for?" And then like two or three words, you know, DBA Toronto or SQL Developer St. Louis.
Yeah.
Okay. And then you put like a question mark there at the end.
Yeah.
And everybody retweets it until finally the right person sees it. Blimey! They call you.
I didn't realize it was that easy.
Yeah.
Well,
it's freaky easy. Freaky.
That's for
okay,
you.
Back
that's
to you,
your
animal.
Big tip. That's your big tip. Thanks,
that's your
Jared,
big tip.
For 2014. Okay.
Yep.
Now, look, I'm going to say a little bit of your history, so I'm not going to force you to say it. You've been in this business for 15 years. Everybody, just so you know, I know you're not going to change because I tell you to, but recruiting is a business. It's not an industry. In an industry, you manufacture something. We don't manufacture. We just shuffle people around. Okay? So you've been in the business for 15 years.
How can there be
years.
A financial industry?
There isn't. Okay, so although they do create financial instruments, we're not going to go and spend too much time on that, Jerry, but out, okay? This guy, Dave, was a partner in a boutique recruiting firm specializing in Java programmers, and then in 2011, he went entirely on his own. So he's now specializing. He works with startups and small software firms to find senior and intermediate-level technology hires. I'm not sure what those are, but we'll get to it. But I noticed, I read a newspaper article about you, and it said this first company you were in, you were the fourth hire there. It grew to 15 people, this recruiting firm, and then it shrunk back to two. What happened? Why?
That was actually, I mean, the company itself was much bigger than that. The company itself was, the article referenced, I believe, just the local office. So the local office, I was the fourth hire. Grew to 15, went back down to 2. The company itself, nationwide and actually international, they had a couple offices in Europe, was probably closer to 200 employees. That particular office, honestly, was mismanaged. There was the recruiting manager there, I think, was more concerned with metrics than performance to some degree, if that makes any sense.
Just as a side note. My office is terribly mismanaged, so we've got that going for us.
There you go. Well, good luck to you. You'll be down to two in no time.
Yep.
So, the for example, my partner and I was part of a two-man recruiting team, and he was the account manager. I was the recruiter. The company had been around for about 15 years at the time. We broke the company record for billing in our second year, and by our third year, my boss at the time had been fired. The top recruiter of the company for, you know, in two of his first 3 years of the company, and he gets fired. And it wasn't for performance, obviously. It was basically they were afraid he was going to start. So there was some political kind of shuffling and things like that.
He billed
also,
too
a lot
much,
of people,
and they were
they
afraid that he might not bill too much the next year or what? I mean,
no, they were afraid he was going to – I think they preemptively fired him before he was going to go start his own thing. Is the way I kind of interpreted it. But that office went for, you know, of the 15 people, they hired a lot of folks. They didn't do enough, I think, research and due diligence before they were hiring. And this is in a boom period.
That's weird.
That the tail end, I guess, of the dot-com boom. And a lot of folks just – it was the way that the company paid was pure commission with some – a draw against commissions. A lot of folks just simply didn't cut it. They were, you know –
Okay, you know what? I'm not going to. I mean, that was a waste of 5 minutes for the show. I mean, the company went from 15 people down to two, and you gave me a non-answer. Okay, let's forget
it. We understand it. They fired all of their producers because they were afraid those producers would leave.
They fired two producers, and they ended up.
I said forget it.
Okay.
Okay.
Forgotten.
Now, here's a big topic for you. You are a super niche recruiter. You absolutely hate generalist recruiters. You feel like you're a street peddler out there with a suitcase full of gadgets to sell when you're recruiting on a generalist basis. So you narrowed your focus down to just Java programmers. Is that right? You want to tell us something about that?
Yeah,
that streamlined approach?
Back in 99, I guess it was, I had a couple of clients in the Philadelphia, and not only am I focused on a technology, at least I was focused on a technology, I'm focused on the geography as well. So back in 99, there were a handful of startups that were looking for, at the time, Java professionals, and they were willing to pay, you know, big money. We were getting 33% retainers, essentially, for Java pros. Decided to focus our business, or my business at least, on that area. And as you, I don't think you mentioned this or not, but I also founded the Java user group in Philadelphia. That kind of came out of that. As I started to learn more and more about the Java community in Philadelphia, and I started to learn more of the players, a handful of them would ask me, you know, Dave, where's the, is there a local Java user group in Philadelphia? And I just tell them no and kind of move along. And then at some point someone says to me, you know all the Java professionals, why don't you start one? So I started the Java user group back in 2000, and between 99 and maybe 2010, I focused exclusively on, again, one geography, Philadelphia, and one technology, Java. Since then, I'm still focused geographically on the Philadelphia area, but not as focused on Java. And again, I don't want to get into too much of the technology here, but a lot of folks in the Java world have moved on to different languages. I've kind of followed them, followed the talent. So as my network kind of progressed into different technical areas, I've decided to expand my specialty, expand my searches, and go beyond just Java.
Yeah, but let me ask you
good
something.
Call.
Is it still
good.
Is it still a narrow specialty? I mean, even though these Java people have evolved into these other languages, is it still a
Java
fairly...
Yeah.
It's dead. So it's just history, and you've moved on, but you've still got a very narrow focus or not a narrow focus?
It's a pretty narrow focus. It's people that, you know, if you go back, you know, if you go back to, let's say, the mid-90s, the people that were doing C++ programming, for example, eventually went into Java. As C++ lost some favor in certain areas, then Java came on board. As the Internet came alive, Java became very popular. As Java's popularity started to somewhat fade or dwindle, I guess, and some other languages became more popular, these same people, so you have this one group of engineers that essentially weren't focused on Microsoft technologies, I guess, is the thing they have in common.
You know what? I like the way you present yourself. Your voice is interesting. It's not boring. I don't have to tell you to pep up like I have to tell so
yep.
many people.
I'm with you there.
You're going off on tangents. I can't get a straight answer out of you. Look,
Dude, what a,
you said
that was
I'm
as straight
start,
an answer as you can get.
No,
tell him, Jerry. Tell him.
I know the real answer.
Hey, Dave. Animal wants short answers, not necessarily thorough
okay.
or any other category. Short.
Let's do crossfire. I can do that too.
No,
crossfire.
Hey, look, this isn't a school essay. You don't have to pad it with lots of background. I read the news article. I know the answers before I'm asking you, and I'm just hoping that you can give the same answers.
But the listeners didn't read the article. The listeners are here. Guess what they're doing? Listening.
Look, you know, yeah, I'm getting stabbed in the back by Jerry, sort of like
I know.
Staff. Thanks. Okay, look, you said that by focusing on such a narrow profession or pool of candidates, you put all your effort into building a database. And it's not diverse, it's narrow. So you have a bigger database than anybody because you're just doing, that's all you're doing. You know, building a database of Java people. And so then you said when someone asks you for a certain kind of person, you've got all those people at your fingertips, and you can find a hire on the first resume, and you said in this business, that doesn't happen very often. I was, like, really inspired. I was thinking, well, geez, is that the, you know, is that the formula for success? Really, really narrow down. But now you're kind of telling me that's not true. Or are you just saying it's not Java anymore, but yes, I'm that narrow. I have a huge database of only one kind of person. I don't make hamburgers and hot dogs and chips and pancakes. I just make burgers.
You're close. So the article you're referring to goes back a few years, but in essence what happened was a lot of recruiters, you know, in my experience, were focused on technology, and they thought they were specialists because they were focused on technology. And then you have, you know, you break down technology, and within technology, you may have, let's say I had a search. I'll give you an example. When I started in the business, I had a search for something called RPG. RPG is...
Dude, you're talking my language, baby.
What's that?
RPG, dude. I love it.
You love RPG? Okay, so my first search was RPG, and I'm looking all over the country to bring these RPG guys to some little company in actually a bank in Delaware. So I'm working on the search, and I'm calling people in Indiana and all over the country. And then I realize when I'm done with the search, I don't have any other RPG customers.
No synergy.
What am I going to do with all these kids that I've talked to?
No traction.
So, exactly. So they're not reusable, essentially. So I decided at that point, well, if I focus on the technology and I focus on the geography, every candidate I talk to is going to be reusable. I can actually keep in touch with them. I can communicate with them on a regular basis. They'll come back to me when they're looking for work because they know I have a specialty. And that's kind of how it worked out. I've kind of gone beyond the Java focus just because those folks are those folks have graduated beyond – a lot of those folks have graduated beyond Java.
If you were going to switch a niche, if you were going to switch your niche tomorrow, how would you go about doing it?
I'd probably switch – if I were to switch it for me, for my business personally, I might switch to, say, mobile developers, let's say. I might switch to people –
Oh, okay, so you – no, I mean if you weren't going to switch to a related niche where you just have to use your current expertise. Let's say you're going to do something completely different, but you still believed in niche recruiting. Do you have a process you would follow, or would – just say, Animal, I don't know. I'd have to think about that.
I won't waste time
with you thinking on the air.
I think that one of the things you have to do is develop credibility within that niche. I developed a lot of credibility by becoming the founder of this user group. This user group had, at its height, and it's still an active user group, but I'm still running it. I've been running it for 13 years. But the user group has 1,300 members. Which isn't huge. It's not huge, but
it's respectable.
Well, I'll tell you what. I get between 80 and 150 at every meeting that I have. I have a meeting once a month.
How many recruiters are trying to cram into those meetings and join your users group?
I don't let them in. How many are trying to?
Yeah.
All of them.
Yeah.
And frankly, I tell them if you want to, I was like, my user group. Then here's another thing about the user group is I keep the user group non-commercial, so I don't recruit out of the user group either. The user group does give me credibility. What's that?
You've never accidentally recruited one of your 1,300 user group users?
They know if they know what I do, then they might approach me. But I don't approach individuals unless they approach me and say, "Hey, Dave, I'm looking for work.
That's
I know you're the founder of the user group. Do you know anyone that can help me?" I'm like, "Well, yeah, I can help you. That's what I do."
You're crazy. That's what the user group is for.
You're crazy.
You don't want the losers. You don't want the losers coming to you and saying, "Dave, I need a job, please. Nobody wants me. You help me." That's not
people,
what you want. You want to pick and choose the guys you know are good and say, "Look, I've got a position. Would you consider it?" Yeah, you do it in a subtle way. You don't bug them, but that's what your user group is for. It's not a charity.
You think I haven't heard this before? The user group is certainly helpful to my career. It's certainly been helpful to my business. But I don't. What the thing is you've got these carpetbagger recruiters that want to come in. They've got one Java search, and they want to come in and say, "Oh, you run the Java user group. I'd love to come to your meeting and talk to your users about X, Y, Z." And I say,
about resume tips and how to maximize their LinkedIn
profile.
We don't
do that. Exactly. We don't do that. Our user group is a purely technical group. There are other networking groups that might be a better fit for these recruiters to come in and do their thing. And I've heard complaints from other area user group leaders that these recruiters come in, they're bumping into people at the meeting, dropping business cards off, and the user group turns into a meat market. One of the ways that I've kind of kept – you know, myself and my user group above a lot of the other local user groups is by avoiding commercial activity. The only real commercialism, I guess, involved is we have sponsorship. So a company will sponsor a meeting, and they pay for the pizza and the soda and all that stuff. Other than that, there's no other money.
Okay, I'm moving on.
Exchanged.
You've got what you call the engaged business model. The engaged business model. First, though, there's a lot of people here. Does anybody want to talk to Dave Fikak before I move on to the next question? Anybody caught a comment for Dave Fikak? No. Okay. So
I've got just one kind of a side question.
Yeah.
How do you keep all the weirdos out of your Philly Jugs group? Because that would be something that, you know, some weirdos would find rather interesting and wanting to sign up.
Define weirdo, I guess.
Yeah, there's a lot of them.
I don't really have any.
Do you screen? Well, I mean, how do you do? How do you keep? How do you ensure that they're the right people?
If someone tries to sign up for the group, I'll usually look up their name on LinkedIn or something like that. See who they are, what they do.
Thirteen years ago, there was no LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's why I had all the weirdos there, I guess. Back in the day, actually, we didn't even have a website at one point, so people
it was more of a speakeasy. You had to find out about the group through other people.
Okay, yeah. All right. So, you do screen a little bit then. All right.
A little bit.
Okay, engaged business model. You want to tell us what that is?
Sure. The way I work is, and I guess the people, your listeners, I'm sure, are familiar with the different recruiting, with contingency recruiting and engaged recruiting and so on. Retained recruiting, the way I do it is, or engaged recruiting, the way I do it is I require my clients to pay me an upfront flat fee for my services. Let me finish. There's a deposit up front, basically, to engage my services, and there's a flat fee per hire, and you can use the initial investment. You can use the deposit essentially on any individual hire. So I'll give you an example. Let's say you engage me for $5,000. I'm going to charge you a flat fee of, let's say, $10,000 per hire. If you ever want to end the engagement, if you ever want to tell me to, you know, take off, you can give me, you know, $5,000 and I'll go away, or you can give me $10,000, let it ride, and we'll continue on. I'll continue my services for you.
So are you in the end, though, you're a flat fee model agency then?
I do all flat fee, yep. And I just started doing that back when I went independent completely in 2011 and started my own company. That's when I went with the flat fee.
Do you have some sense for what that percentage ends up being?
I do. My percentages are around, I think last year, and I'm sorry, I didn't do the figures for 2013 yet. In 2012, my average fee was around 11%, which is really low.
Okay, Chad Balby's got a question. Chad was the last guest. He says,
I'm just letting that 11% fee just set in.
Yeah, okay, we'll get back to that.
It's overwhelming me.
Why is Dave Fikak saying he's got 1,300 members when his LinkedIn group only has 349?
Because there are about 900 people that are not in the group. They're on LinkedIn. There's a lot of people in the Java user group that are on LinkedIn that aren't in the LinkedIn group.
Okay.
I would tell Chad that I have a mailing list of 1,300 members. 1,290 something, I think, at the moment.
You see,
but no.
My listeners, they're investigative. They're not afraid to ask questions. They know that's the culture on this show. You can't just, you know, come on this show with mere puffery. Now, Jerry's going to be asking you a few questions about that fee.
Sure.
What benefits have you got out of that fee? I mean, are they happy to say, oh, you're pretty low rent. I'm happy to work with you. Or do they say, let's go. Do they go back to their other recruiters and say, Dave Fikak is only charging me $10,000 and you're charging me $20,000?
I don't know if they're going back to the other firms or not. But I, you know, generally speaking, my business, I'm more exclusive with my clients than most recruiters, I believe, are in the industry today. So a lot of my clients aren't using a lot of firms. They might be using one or two.
So you're getting your retainer or engagement fee and then taking care of business.
Yeah. I mean, it's okay.
I mean,
I could certainly charge more, but when I'm charging more, I'm putting myself in the same pool as everyone else, and I'm competing with everyone else. I'm personally, this is just the way my life works. I would rather have a client exclusively at, let's say it was 10% contingency, for all intents and purposes it is, if I would rather have a client at 10% with an exclusive than fight 15 other recruiters for 20% or 25% or whatever the going
Angela,
rate is.
That question's coming. We're going to come. Angela Kapalovich wants to know about your guarantees. We'll get to that. Don't let anybody, you know, forget
it. So is it safe to say that? Hey.
Okay.
Hey.
Go ahead.
Sometimes I have quits. I'm an actual recruiter animal. Let a recruiter talk to this guy.
You know what? I can mute you, okay, if I have to. Let me ask
you a
question.
I'll mute myself.
Let me ask him a question.
No, here's the one question, though.
Okay, go ahead.
So in a sense, then, you are filling every job that you work on and make that agreement with.
I've returned an engagement fee for one client last year. I returned a fee for it wasn't a good fit for what I would do and what they were their expectations and what I generally do weren't a good fit. So,
but for the most part, when you agree to a 10% fee or whatever your flat fee is, you're filling that job. So that's not then going to be a customer who's then expecting the next recruiter to agree to that same fee, even though you weren't able to deliver. Is that accurate?
I'm not sure I understood the entire question.
I run into quite a few companies, more so the last couple months for some reason. I don't know whether I'm just marketing more or whatever the story is.
Sure.
That are expecting me to agree to ridiculously low fees that other agencies have or are currently agreed to.
Okay.
And so I'm just trying to understand where that is all coming from. When why should one agency have to agree to the fee another agency charge but could not deliver?
You are wrecking the show.
I personally feel fees are too high. I mean, I'm sure that people on your listeners are not going to like that too much. I think that the fees being as high as they are creates a lot of the problems in the industry.
Yeah, hold on, Dave. Dave,
wow.
Mr. VCAC, listen to me. Okay? The thing is, though, you're not just, when you were just pumping out these Java programmers, and I assume they all did the exact same thing. There weren't different kinds of Java programmers. So you had
There are, but go ahead.
Okay, well, maybe that even makes it more diversified than I'm thinking of. But you only had, you had a huge database. You were pumping out these guys. Okay, $10,000 a pop. Fine. But you knew how to do the process, and it was just so under control. But now, if you're doing a wider range of people, you don't all have them all sitting in your database. You got to go out and look for them. So you might be looking really hard for some people, and it's taken up a ton of your time, so you can't make all those $10,000 fees. You don't want any more money for the hard-to-find guys. Is that what you're saying?
Not exactly, no. Most of the searches that I'm taking on are going to be people that are generally in my network already. So most of my traffic regarding – this might be a little bit strange for you as well, but most of my traffic regarding candidates is actually incoming, and almost all my traffic regarding clients is incoming. I've developed a name for myself in the local market where I don't do much marketing. I don't do a whole lot of, I don't do any cold calling or anything like that. I get some, referrals and things of that nature, but I'm not, I'll do some look through LinkedIn and
so
things like that.
So you're not an average recruiter. You're not. You've got a model that suits your specific position in the Philadelphia
absolutely,
market.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I built a reputation as someone who, treated clients or candidates really well. Clients like Workman because I'm not sending resumes every 10 seconds. I'm sending, for my average search, I'm sending maybe two or three resumes sometimes. My hit rate last year was probably, as far as interviews go, was probably over 50%, where 50% of the resumes I'm sending out are getting job offers.
Do you believe that your business is due to your low fee? Or your expertise.
It's my expertise,
Kathy,
I believe.
Kathy wants to ask him something. And I'll answer that question. Kathy, I'll get right to you in a sec. His low fee is a function of his database and his leadership of this community. He doesn't have to work very hard.
No, the leadership, the community's dead.
No.
The community is actually not dead. The community is still pretty, I got 100 people at meetings in the fall. You know, 100 isn't
so
a ton of people.
He doesn't have to work to find people. He doesn't have to work to find
okay.
people. That's his whole thing. Everything's incoming. The clients come to him. The candidates come to him. He doesn't have to do anything so he can afford to charge a low fee. That's what it sounds like to me.
If you build a reputation, if you build a reputation that's entirely positive, or, never entirely, but 99% positive, your candidates are willing to – candidates will come to you. So I got an email yesterday from a guy who just got laid off from a company locally. And he basically said in the email, I hate recruiters. I would never work with a recruiter. But two people at my office said you were a good guy and you help them and you write a newsletter once a month and give a lot of free information and help people, blah, blah, blah. You know, you're the kind of person that would recommend sometimes for people not to take my job. You know, I might have a job for somebody. I might have a job offer for you, but if you get a better offer from someone else, I might say, hey, you know what, my offer might not be best for you. Is it a disservice to my client? I mean, you could potentially say it is, you could potentially say it isn't, but I'm the kind of person that kind of shoots from the hip on those kind of things. And for that, candidates come to me, and clients tend to respect me. Clients, even, you know, I'll tell clients, don't hire my guy sometimes. He's not the best fit. That happens, you know, if you're willing to be honest, if you're willing to take yourself outside of the – here's the other side of that is I'm willing to do that because my reputation isn't worth $10,000. It's worth a lot more than that. So I'm not – you know, if I was looking for a $40,000 or $50,000 fee, a lot of recruiters that are looking at those kind of fees are willing to do a lot of things that I'm not willing to do because my fees aren't that high. I'm not going to sell my reputation for $10,000. A lot of people have a hard, you know, if you're getting into this industry and you're 3 years in, you've got student loans, whatever the case may be, and you're staring at a $50,000 fee, it's probably a lot of things you're willing to say for $50,000.
He's right. That's a really good point.
Thank you.
And
once you've been doing it
for
a while,
you.
Your reputation is not worth $50,000.
I don't think that I would change my morals or ethics regardless of whether it was $10 or $10,000 or $100,000.
I'm going to disagree with that.
You've
been in the business for a long time. It's a very easy decision for me to make, having been successful in the business for 15 years, and it's probably an easy decision for you to make as well. But if you put that, if you're struggling, if you're 3 or 4 years in the business, and you're making, you know, 50 grand a year, 40 grand a year, and you might have $100,000 in debt, and you just had a baby and you have a new car.
Okay, Kathy Mattis, welcome to 2014. She's
Kathy's Corner.
Thank you. I think you have a good point about your reputation, and I kind of agree with you, especially with people that have not created their reputation yet, that a large fee could impact whether they would recommend a candidate for hire or not. But my question is, do you have a larger number of candidates that you place for a few clients, or do you have a large number of clients where you place a few candidates?
I have a handful of clients that I place a handful of people with, so I'm not a huge volume business. I'm a one man shop. I'm the only one that works for, you know, it's my name on the marquee and I'm the only one underneath it right now. I've considered hiring some other people, but right now that's not in my immediate future. But I've got, you know, in any given time I might have 6 or 7 engaged clients. And any of those clients might have
quite a few. And then how many?
It's a handful, and they might each have a few different roles. Generally speaking, clients come to me and they say, especially with the engaged model, the way it works best is if a client comes to me and says, you know, Dave, we're looking to round out our team. I need 4, you know, Ruby developers. They generally want the same thing from me 3 or 4 different times. So I can go out on the search and I might already have those people in my network. Usually I do. Or, you know, within 1 degree of separation where I can reach those people relatively quickly. And then, you know, if they've got 4 roles, I might not fill all 4. They might ship out a couple of those roles to other recruiters. But they generally know they can count on me for at least a couple of them.
When you say you have people in your network, I'm assuming that a lot of them are still working. I mean, they're not just sitting there unemployed.
Oh, I'd say, you know, employment within my network is probably over 90%. You know,
okay.
It may be well above 90%. The people that I work with are, you know, are in-demand engineers. And this is, again, I know that all the listeners aren't recruiting software engineers, but very high-end software engineers are going from job to job basically whenever they want. The type of people that I work with and represent are, generally speaking, you know, I could take any one of them to market any given day and probably get 4 or 5 job offers within, you know, within 10 days. They're in that kind of demand. So it's a little bit easier. It's obviously a lot easier to represent those kind of people. Now, of course, there aren't everyone in the network, everyone in my industry isn't of that level. Go ahead.
So are you then in no way interested in working with any of the other, say, the other two or three places that you could get an offer for that guy, are you not interested in them, even though they would happily pay twice or even three times the fees that you're charging now? I mean, you're almost really shutting the door to the average fees being paid. And I'm just really having a hard time with it, man.
I mean, I could always open. There's companies that have offered me contingency deals. You know, for example, I'll go to some of my clients, or not my clients, but I'll go to some client prospects and say, here's the way I work, here's my business model. You know, it requires upfront money, whatever it is, $5,000, $7,000, whatever the case may be. And they might say, well, listen, I can't get approved. You know, HR won't approve that, or, you know, the CEO of the company is a little uncomfortable with giving money upfront for something. Because my initial fee, my upfront fee, has no guarantee whatsoever. It's guaranteed for me, basically. I bill you something, you know, I send you an invoice, and there is no guarantee behind that whatsoever. That is a non-refundable deposit, regardless of the situation. Now, again, I've refunded it once or twice in my career based on my own decisions, but it's a non-refundable investment. So I could potentially take, you know, if they say, no, Dave, we're not willing to do a non-refundable investment with you, they might say, you know, we can't get approval on it. I could take a contingency search for them at maybe 15 or 20% or whatever they're offering, 25. You know, usually I'm seeing 15 to 20 usually these days.
It's the business model more so than the fee. Then all companies are at least paying a 20% fee. Half of them are happily paying a 25% fee.
Sure.
So. I'm just kind of boggled, man.
I'm not competing with anyone. So, like I said earlier, if you want to compete, you know, you want that 25% fee. Well, guess what? They're going to have, at least in Philadelphia, the way it works, you're going to have 15 other recruiting companies that you're competing against.
But
what are you doing?
Like
Everyone's all over LinkedIn, or everyone's all over Twitter, wherever they are.
Sure.
They're blasting out the same exact. I'll give you an example. One of my clients, one of my old clients years ago, in the Philadelphia area. You've worked with basically every recruiter in the Philadelphia area, even some national firms. Fairly well-known company in the area. I'm sure that anyone in Philly would know who they are. But they're, you know, big e-commerce company, and their job specs would go out to all these different recruiters, and then you'd start emailing candidates. You'd send out the announcements on the job. They all knew who it was before you even came because they had heard from everyone else. So you've got to then, you know, it's the job spec goes out to all the recruiters on Monday morning. And then, you know, Monday at 9 o'clock, you start blasting everything to people. You got to be the first person to talk to them. You got to drop everything to make sure that you're the first person to talk to this person. Then you've got to get a right to represent signed, and then this and that. I don't want to do that. I'm sorry. Like the money isn't that important to me.
Okay. Yeah.
I'd rather take the 10% on or $10,000 whatever flat fees on my terms than have to compete with everyone else that's in the same rat race for the higher fee. Because I'll tell you what, I'm feeling, you know, it's not really it's not a contingency search when if I'm making 50% of what someone else is making per hire, but I'm not competing against anyone of the firms. I'm pretty much guaranteed I'm going to fill that role. I'm going to get that money. I'd rather take that than put myself into the pool and have to swim against everyone else that's competing for the same hires.
Okay, yeah, cool.
Well, let me ask you a question. How come, since you're in the techie market, Jerry says, the best way to be in the tech market is to be placing contract people. You're placing permanent people, right? Direct.
I've done contract before. I've done contract in the past. The reason I don't do contract now is essentially the pay model. Whereas most candidates, most big recruiting firms, have the ability to essentially payroll someone. You know, I'm paying my. You got to pay your employees every 2 weeks, but you're only getting paid by your clients every 90 days. So I'd have to float you essentially. You know, if these guys are making $80-$100 an hour, I've got to float you. You know, $4,000 a week for 12 weeks.
Man, I got started by using a factoring company.
Yeah,
Temp-works.
I know there's places
Temp-works.
Like that that exist.
TempWorks is one of our sponsors on the show.
Yeah,
you know, Greg Dergarian's a nice guy.
Is there plenty of opportunity for contracting there?
There's a good amount of contracting work around here. I've kind of been known over the years for perm placement. At one point in my career, when I was with that other company about 5 or 6 years ago, we were about 50-50 in terms of placement numbers. But in terms of revenue, we were probably 70-30 on the contract you know, 70-30 favoring.
Jerry, do you
think
he's making a big mistake? Jerry, do you think he's making a big mistake by not using his credibility to move into the contract market?
I don't know if he's making a big mistake.
Leaving a lot of money on the table?
Yep. It could be.
Okay.
But money doesn't motivate this guy.
I'm motivated
yes,
by money as much as some people. Here's the thing is I'm definitely not as motivated by money as the recruiters out there that are willing to sell their reputation for a $40,000 or $30,000
stake. Yeah, that's another issue, okay?
I don't see much. I don't understand that, though. I don't see much of that going on, selling their reputation. I mean, just –
recruiters
that are willing to lie, and recruiters
that are willing to misrepresent their clients or misrepresent their candidates in order to obtain a fee. That's what I'm saying. Selling reputation. Where
but
you've
really,
got,
you're saying
I mean,
that's common. He's saying that's common.
Yeah,
he wrote
that's not
it
common
it
because
blog.
you could only misrepresent it to get to the interview. Once the people are sitting down for an interview, they're talking about the real story, regardless of what you said.
You mean so you're leading the horse to water, but you're not making him drink. Basically, that's what you're saying.
I'm just saying people aren't having to lay their reputation on the line for, you know, standard agency fees. You know, standard agency fees are 25%.
I frankly disagree.
There's a lot of dishonest recruiters. People hate them. He's not one of them. Jerry's saying you can't survive in this business if you're dishonest because you're going to get found out right away.
Right, but he just disagreed that the average fee is 25%, and I'm...
No, I'm not disagreeing with that. I'm disagreeing with the fact that people aren't willing to lie for 25%.
Mr. Fekak, I got to get to Angela before I forget about her. She's got two questions.
Sure.
She wants to know if you offer guarantees.
Angela who?
Angela Kapalovich.
Kapalovich, okay.
90-day guarantees.
Hi, Angela.
What is it?
90-day guarantee. On the placement fee only. There's no guarantee, like I mentioned, on the deposit up front, the initial deposit, guarantee whatsoever. On the back end, though, on the placement fee per hire, a 90-day guarantee.
Is it cash guarantee, or are you going to replace the guy?
I'll do a cash guarantee. You know, it usually says replacement or cash. It's the client's option. I'm open to either one.
Okay.
I'm not afraid. You know, I can say I've refunded a fee maybe once in my 15 years.
Yeah, it rarely happens.
Yeah, it's pretty rare.
She also wants to know, it's not 100% clear, once they give you this $5,000, do they give you an exclusive as well or not? It sounds like you get an exclusive just by default because if they can get a guy for 10, you know, who's got the year-low fees, they're not going to give it out to other recruiters. You don't ask them to sign for an exclusive.
No, there's no guarantee on the exclusive. I don't ask for a signature on an exclusive kind of arrangement like that. If they want to work with other firms, they can. I mean, they obviously have an incentive to hire through me, assuming those other recruiters are charging, you know, standard market rates, so to speak. The incentive is to hire through me. But, you know, I'm not really working in the same circles as other recruiters. It's a niche industry. I'm working with small startup companies that are typically flying under the radar that are getting a lot. Sometimes they get a lot of calls from recruiters when they announce, you know, we just got $20 million investment, and every recruiter in town calls them. But the reputations, you know, of the clients I'm working with right now, of my active clients, all of them came to me. All of them approached me and said, Dave, we heard you do good things. We need help. Can you help us? So when someone approaches you and asks you, they tell you they want your service, you tell them, you know, here's the price. You want to use my services. Here's what I charge. It's a lot different than going out to companies and having to try to sell your business. Now, I've done some of that as well, obviously. Tried to sell my business model to some people, and it's worked. It's been successful for most, and you know, unsuccessful for others. But when someone comes to you and says, "Hey, I need your help. What can you do for me?" You tell them your price. And generally they pay it.
Okay. I got to address Carla Porter. Carla, you know, I've been doing the show for almost 7 years. You think I haven't? You know, they got a chat box on Blog Talk Radio. People prefer. People decide themselves. The people decided they want to have the chat on Twitter. That's fine with me, okay? I don't want to force people to go to Blog Talk Radio. They want to talk on Twitter. What's wrong with that? Thanks for asking, Carla. But I don't think that was a reasonable question. Anyway, let's go. But you can ask any question. I don't care. I'm open.
So your guest, nice guy, he's got a system that works for him. He's not out setting the world on fire. You know, I mean, that's his style.
That's
cool. It's cool. It's
okay.
Terry, question, though. If you float contractors, don't you have to provide a lot of insurance on them and stuff? I mean, isn't that really costly or not?
Not really. You mean
depends on the arrangement, too. I know in the past we've required the contractor to actually carry their own insurance. They carry their own liability insurance. They have to actually – it depends on the situation, but I think they have to carry workers' comp, even though it's, you know, it's not a
dangerous
profession.
What I've seen over the last couple of years is a lot of these HR departments have tightened up, and they don't want me to have anyone other than a W-2 employee working as a contractor at my customer.
Mm-hmm.
So
you know, they're not
that
into this whole 1099 subcontractor, H-1B, triple vendor deal. They want your employee there, and, you know, you have to have, you know, not only workers' comp, but in many cases, proprietary non-disclosure insurance,
right,
fiduciary bonding and stuff. But no, it's not a ton.
But
not
that's, you know, that's again another barrier to entry for someone like myself who's running a small shop, you know, on your own. You've got, I'm up there competing against these, you know, multi-million-dollar recruiting firms. Who are, you know, getting on these, you know, large company vendor lists and things like that. For a small company, for the kind of clients that I work with that have, you know, under 100 employees, things like that, that makes it
more attractive for you to work for.
Well,
them.
I can work with those smaller firms because they can also usually I can adjust their pay schedules. If I'm working with a client with has, you know, 50 employees, I'm dealing with the CEO. I say, hey, listen, you want to hire a contractor through me, you can do that, but
yeah.
I need payment every 2 weeks or I need payment once a month. I'm not going to let you go 90 days without paying me. But you've got these, you know, if I'm working with the, you know, the big bank, they're not going to pay, you know, Dave Fekak different than they pay, you know, giant tech corporation recruiting firm.
The usual pay is 20 to 30 days.
Not Mike. I've done a lot of it. Believe me, I'm not a newbie to contract recruiting in the tech industry. I never got paid earlier than 60 days.
Wow.
But again, it depends on, you know, it could be a regional thing. I have no idea. But I had never gotten paid more than in any earlier than 60 days on.
Really?
And these are mostly larger clients. So these are clients, billion-dollar clients.
If you know that in advance, tack on $5 an hour to your bill rate.
You're competing against people that have a lot deeper pockets than you do. You're competing against people that, you know, for a couple hundred thousand dollars.
Once you're using
a
funding company, your pockets are as deep as theirs.
Sure.
I agree.
It's those kind of companies that are a little more recent, you know, in as far as when I was doing my contract work, it was probably, you know, 99 till like 2008 or 2009.
It's a lot easier now, man.
It is a lot easier. You're right.
I
certainly would not turn away from it if my clients were asking for it. My clients currently aren't asking for it.
Okay. Look. What did I want to say? Oh, you know, Kathy has a son. She said she's not a secret, who's autistic. And Dave married a woman who has an autistic child, a beautiful little girl. Her picture's on the site for the show. So
that's
that was
right.
An interesting article. I was an interesting. You're a stepdad, autistic stepdad. You said, right?
What a guy
well,
you are!
I am a stepfather to a stepdaughter with autism. She's 9 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Okay. Well, things worked out well for Kathy. So I hope in your life they work out that way as well.
thank you.
Let me see. Okay, money. Okay. Well, actually, posting job descriptions. Do you post your job descriptions anywhere, or do you just convey them by word of mouth?
I post them on my website, which gets picked up. I use a site called Indeed. I'm sure people are familiar with Indeed.
Yep.
Indeed, you know, if you sponsor one or two jobs on there, it generally spiders the rest of your jobs. So that's the only site I've really used. I've used a couple of recently, I guess in the past 3 months, started using a couple very specific small not small, I shouldn't say, but very specific technology sites. There's a site called Stack Overflow that's basically very high-end software engineers are kind of hanging out there. It's more expensive. It's closer to $500 for, I think, $400 maybe for a posting there. But the Indeed uses that pay-per-click stuff, so it's a different ballgame.
You know,
but other than that, I don't post to 50 different places. I only post a couple places. I tweet them out. That's about it.
Jerry says, when you post your job, it takes away your chance to describe it to the candidate yourself and deal with any objections in person. Is that an issue for you?
My business is built on transparency, so it's a little different. I'll give you an example. If you go to my website, you can find out who my clients are. I heard your last call. I listened to your last show in December where Chad was the guest, and he was talking about – he did the role-playing, and he wouldn't talk about the client name. My client names are listed on my website.
Do you know Chad?
I don't know Chad. I don't know Chad. We're in the same market.
He's
we're
in Philadelphia, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. I don't deal with a lot of recruiters.
We need to have a Philly cage match.
We should
play
a Philly cage match. I'm all in. He looks like a big guy. He looks like
yeah.
he can,
Philly cage
he,
match.
He's
he
a triathlete
a guy,
or something.
Right.
I don't know if I can compete
yeah.
with that.
You look pretty big too. You tower over that bald guy in the picture I posted. But anyway, go ahead.
Where was I?
I don't know. Well, job postings. And
job postings.
Stack Overflow.
I post my jobs on my site, like I said. I'll post my client names right on there. My client names are on my website. So if you wanted to, sidestep me, you certainly could do that. Part of the reason I'm able to do that is because my clients pay me up front. I've got money from my clients, so I'm working for them.
You got $5,000, peanuts.
Well, it's $5,000 more than the next guy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Why do people move?
That was
why
kind of a
move?
Slam, animal.
Why do people
I don't like how you said that to him.
Why do people move?
I wasn't offended. I've been defending my model for a long time. My model has been around for a couple of years. I've been defending it for a while. It's not for everybody. I kind of hope everyone
move?
Else doesn't do it.
I'm in charge of the show, not you. I'm in charge. Listen to me. Why do people move? We've only got a few minutes left, okay?
Go ahead.
Why do people move? I let you guys talk at length without interrupting, and I don't know if everybody's interested in all the stuff about contract versus I found it interesting, however.
Why do
now
people
I
move
know,
in the software industry or in general?
Yeah, why do people move? For money, for new opportunities, technical opportunities? What is it necessary? What attracts a candidate to a new job?
In my industry, in the software industry specifically, there's a handful of things. Most of it in my industry, in my opinion, is stagnation. So if you've got the same person doing the same job over the course of 3, 4, 5 years, not moving around, not doing too much, they're going to leave. They get bored. And that's the nature, to some degree, of the technology industry, where people are always, they're reading about these new technologies being used by other companies. They read about new ways of doing things, and they're always wanting to build something. That's part of the culture, and I know you don't like that word, but part of the culture of being in the software industry is essentially the need to build new things. And what happens is you get hired by a new company. They have to build a certain product or a service, whatever the case may be. They build this site. They build this mobile site, whatever the case may be, and then it's done, and it's built. Well,
yeah,
they don't want to hang
hired?
Around and...
Hold on. Don't you get hired on the basis of your experience? So people really want you to come and bring what you're doing with you. So you're doing the same thing at the new company as you're doing at the old company. That's why they really are hiring you, for your expertise.
Let's use a construction worker as an example. A construction worker builds a house, but would they want to hang out to fix the pipe 6 months from now? No. They want to go out and build a new house. So although they're building the same house, it might be different. It might have different doors and windows, whatever the case may be. But they're continuously building things, and when they're done building something, they move on to the next job. That is the mindset of a lot of people in the technology industry, where they want to continuously be building things, but don't want to hang around.
How do you present? Like I was reading an article the other day, and it said you cannot inspire others if you are not inspired yourself. So, like, are you convinced when you call somebody that this is going to be a great move for you, or are you finding out, like, how do you, when you call a person for a job, what makes you, how do you sell the job, or do you not? Or do you let them sell themselves by just presenting the information and saying, are you interested?
I like to let the job sell itself. I think the biggest thing that I do that's a little different than most recruiters is I like to expose the negatives early on. So I'll tell them, I'd rather have the client do most of the selling for the simple fact that I want them to hear it from the horse's mouth. So if a year from now the promises about, being promoted into this new role or whatever the case may be don't come true, I'm not the one on the hook for the credibility, so to speak. It's their employer. So I'd rather have the clients do most of the selling. But I'll of course, like every other recruiter, I'll tout the company. you know, all the perks about working there and what you enjoy or, you know, what I think they'll like about it. I like to find out from my candidates first what they want to do and then, you know, what are the most important criteria. What are you looking for in a job? Oh, I want to build new things. I want to work with new technologies. Okay, well, this might not be the best shop for you because they're using old technologies. Here's a company that is using new technologies. They might be a better fit for you. Let's talk about that instead.
Okay, and what about money? If they ask you right away, how much is it paying, do you tell them?
No, not really. But I don't. Here's the thing also. This is, again, this is specific to my clients. I'm working with small companies that don't have these specific bands of what they're paying people. You know, at a lot of bigger companies, you've got, you know, software engineer one makes, you know, $78,000 to $83,000, and software engineer two makes $83,000 to $87,000. My clients don't do that. My clients basically tell me we're willing to pay what we need to pay for people. I do have clients that will, you know, that have don't send anyone above, you know, $130,000 or something like that. In which cases, if someone's asking what the company pays, I'll generally tell them, you know, we're wasting our time if we're above X. But
okay,
no,
Once you've told them 130 is the max, doesn't that mean they're going to go for the max and they won't settle for anything less? They'll say, I know this guy's got $130,000.
Absolutely. That's why I don't tell people the money until I usually find out something about where they're at. If they're asking me about money first thing, it's probably a dead conversation.
So what do you say? I'm not going to tell you the money?
Let's find out more about your background and see if it's a fit before we get into the compensation side of things.
That's a nice smooth move. Okay. And
I mean, I don't want to waste their time. And they might think they're wasting their time. I could also say, I can pull it and say, you know, this opportunity might not be a fit for you. I don't know. But let's, you know, I might have positions that are paying what you're looking for in the future.
Okay, Wait a sec. So after the person tells you their background, and you say, yeah, you are fit for this job, and then he or she says, okay, what's it paying? And what do you say then?
I usually say the truth, which is I don't have a range. If I do have a range, I might give it to them. It depends on how the conversation. I really feel it out. It's a play by play kind of thing.
You're telling. So, like for instance, Amy Allen made a real point. I'm not bringing people in who don't tell me because my hiring manager said, if I bring someone in over this amount, it's a waste of his or her time.
If someone's not telling me what they're making or what they're looking for, I can't work with them. No, I don't work with them. If a candidate doesn't tell me up front what they're looking for or what they're making, it's a dead conversation. I don't have time for that.
So when do you ask them what they're making?
Usually about three-quarters of the way into the conversation. So if we're going to do a half-hour profile, about 20 minutes in, after I've asked them what they're looking for, I ask them, like, you know, what are your big your main search criteria? What are the top three things you're looking for in a position? I've built some credibility at that point. I might talk to, you know, some small talk about the companies they've worked for. I'm building credibility. And then I ask them about compensation. If you're asking them about compensation first, they're never going to give you an honest answer, and they're probably not going to give you an answer at all because you haven't built any credibility. You haven't given them anything. You give them something first, give them some information, whatever the information
is. Okay, and
about.
If the guy says, look, Dave, what's the point talking about anything else unless we agree on the money? That's number one issue.
We don't need to agree on the first part of the conversation.
Why should I waste 20 minutes talking to you before we start talking about what the key issue is for me, the money?
I would tell them not to. I would say, hey, save your time. Let's not talk then. That's okay. Again, I'm not going to provide a service for everybody. I'm not going to hunt people down, and I'm not going to try to pin people down on dollars in the very beginning of a conversation. If someone wants to do that, if money is that important to some of these people, then it's probably not a good fit from the way my clients work and the way that I work. I'm not gonna have conversations with people that aren't willing to kind of at least listen to things and have a dialogue. If they just want to, you know, me to focus on giving them every single answer, it's like having people ask about, you know, direct deposit and things like that. Let's get to that later. You know, does the company have direct deposit? Does the company have a 401k match? We don't need to know that the first 3 minutes of the conversation. By the time I've gotten 20 minutes into it, when I've talked to you for 20 minutes, you're going to be willing to tell me the information that I want to have. That's just, if you're any good at what you do, then you're going to have built the credibility in a short period of time to get the information that you need. If you don't, then it's not meant to be.
Okay. I saw on Quora they had a discussion. Which celebrity would you like to punch in the face? Want to answer that question?
You, Jerry. Can I say Jerry?
Okay, that's
yeah,
good.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, Now, listen, we spent a lot of time, as I guess you must have suspected, I didn't know, we spent a lot of time talking about your business model. So there's tons of questions we didn't get to. Maybe you'll come back another time, but I've enjoyed having you. For the Gerst guest for 2014, thank you, Dave Fika!
It's not actually 1 o'clock yet. It's 12:59. I'm a little off my game. I thought I had 60 seconds.
Take a look, Jerry. Take a look. It's 1 o'clock.
No, okay, just now. I go by my computer clock. I don't have some thing with batteries up on the wall, probably like you do, that you set fast just to spur yourself into action before it's really time. God. Good show. I can't do the cut fee business. You know, people justify it in many ways. Sounds like a good guy, and he's got his lifestyle thing going, and that's great. Very cool.
Philadelphia is very different. I lived there for 4 years, and it's very different than a lot of cities. It's cutthroat. So I can understand why he's doing what he's doing. I think it makes sense for that geography.
Well, I think the reduction in fee might attract him to the client, but I think he's leaving money on the table since the other recruiting agencies are going to be pulling up the same folks, aren't they?
Yeah.
He has an exclusive with them, but he doesn't have an exclusive with the candidates. So
I mean, he's in the rat race regardless of whether he wants to acknowledge it or not.
Right.
I don't know.
He's working with small startups. He's not working with these big companies that can afford the huge fees.
Well, he's not working with Aramark in Philly or something like that, you're saying.
Right.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know. But, you know, I liked him. He seems like a really nice guy. Glad to get to know him.
Yeah, I liked him too.
Yeah. How's it going out there, Kathy?
I'm in Denver right now.
Denver?
Broke my foot.
Didn't you love that dad playing the Beatles song with his kid?
I love it.
I've watched it 3 times now. It's just—it's incredible. It's awesome.
Kathy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you make it to the shop before they ran out of stock?
The shop before they ran out of stock. What did I miss?
Denver, Colorado.
Colorado.
I've been seeing a lot of posts and over their newly adopted laws there.
I would move to a state that had legal marijuana.
You know what? My husband and I actually discussed that. But he is a federal judge, and since it's not federally approved, we are not going to partake.
I wouldn't want to run into all those stoned-out druggies. I mean, crazy.
I know. I know. And the ones that were interviewed were embarrassing. It's like... they couldn't wait to just veg on their couch. I mean, it was just,
So did you have a good Christmas?
It was okay. My husband was sick the whole time. We didn't really celebrate until, like, the 28th. Yeah. How about you? Your tree was incredible.
Well, thank you.
How'd you get it out?
You just cut it up into little pieces.
God.
Yeah. I loved our tree. Loved it. You know, I have such a busy day going here. Hey, Travis, I just sent you something. Don't say anything. Don't say anything about it.
I'm not. We'll commence here momentarily.
I'm just doing some research, but that looks legit. Looks legit.
Yes.
We should be able to help those people.
Yes, I will exploit the opportunity.
Maybe we need to start just going with the cut fee deal. I tell you, if we had a $5,000 retainer on every job order that we worked on, that'd be great.
That could work.
And we would come out further ahead even if we filled none of them, you know? I just don't know how to think about a 10% fee. That's just not why I'm in the recruiting business, because of the high fees, you know? I don't know, man. It's crazy. But I don't have any further time to devote to the after show because I have a 1 o'clock call, and it's 105, 104. So feel free to talk amongst yourselves, et cetera, get scores and that kind of stuff, but I got to go.
I have to go, too, but I'm going to give them both 90s. I thought it was a good show.
Okay.
Real quick.
Super. Thanks, Kathy.
Okay. Happy
Travis,
New Year.
I'll call you back in a little bit. Have a good year, Kathy. Anybody
Bye.
Else still on the phone here? Nobody. Lame.